Recorded Books and One Click Digital present Lincoln by David Herbert Donald, narrated by Norman Dietz.
Preface. The only time I ever met President John F. Kennedy, in February 1962, he was unhappy with historians. A group of scholars had been in the Oval Office hoping to enlist him in a poll that ranked American presidents. I wasn't one of those visitors. But the next day, when I gave a talk in the White House about Abraham Lincoln, the subject was much on his mind. He voiced his deep dissatisfaction with the glib way the historians had rated some of his predecessors as below average, and marked a few as failures, thinking, no doubt, of how his own administration would look in the backward glance of history. He resented the whole process. With real feeling, he said, "No one has a right to grade a president, not even poor James Buchanan, who hasn't sat in his chair, examined the mail and information that came across his desk, and learned why he made his decisions." This book was conceived in the spirit of President Kennedy's observations. In tracing the life of Abraham Lincoln, I've asked at every stage of his career what he knew, when he had to take critical actions, how he evaluated the evidence before him, and why he reached his decisions. It is, then, a biography written from Lincoln's point of view, using the information and ideas that were available to him. It seeks to explain rather than to judge. My biography is based largely on Lincoln's own words, whether in his letters and messages or in conversations recorded by reliable witnesses. I've tried, as far as possible, to write from the original sources, that is, from first-hand contemporary accounts by people who saw and talked with the president. Of course, I've consulted the voluminous secondary literature, but I've used it chiefly for letters and documents that I couldn't find elsewhere. My approach was made possible by the availability of the Abraham Lincoln papers in the Library of Congress, now, fortunately, on microfilm. After use by Lincoln's authorized biographers, John G. Nicolay and John Hay, in 1890, these papers were sealed until 1947, and therefore couldn't be consulted for the major biographies by Albert J. Beveridge, William E. Barton, Carl Sandburg, and J. G. Randall. The results of my inquiries can most readily be defined in negative terms. This book is not a general history of the United States during the middle of the 19th century. I have stuck close to Lincoln, who was only indirectly connected with the economic and social transformations of the period. It's not even a history of the Civil War. There is, for example, almost nothing in the following pages about the internal affairs of the Confederacy, because these were matters that Lincoln couldn't know about. It's not a military history. I haven't described campaigns and battles that Lincoln didn't witness. I haven't offered a broad philosophical discussion of the origins of the Civil War. And I haven't addressed the question of whether it was the first modern war. These are important subjects, but they didn't present themselves to Abraham Lincoln in any practical way. I haven't asked whether Lincoln freed the slaves or the slaves freed themselves, because Lincoln never considered these roads to emancipation as mutually exclusive. Certainly he knew that thousands of slaves, in individual heroic acts of rebellion, were leaving their masters to seek freedom behind the Union lines. But he also knew that ending the institution of slavery required official action on the part of the United States government. In focusing closely on Lincoln himself, on what he knew, when he knew it, and why he made his decisions, I have, I think, produced a portrait rather different from that in other biographies. It is perhaps a bit more grainy than most, with more attention to his unquenchable ambition, to his brain-numbing labor in his law practice, to his tempestuous married life, and to his repeated defeats. It suggests how often chance or accident played a determining role in shaping his life, and it emphasizes his enormous capacity for growth, which enabled one of the least experienced and most poorly prepared men ever elected to high office to become the greatest American president. More important, this biography highlights a basic trait of character evident throughout Lincoln's life: the essential passivity of his nature. Lincoln himself recognized it in a letter he wrote on April 4, 1864, to Albert G. Hodges, a fellow Kentuckian, who asked him to explain why he'd shifted from his inaugural pledge not to interfere with slavery to a policy of emancipation. After relating how circumstances had obliged him to change his mind, how emancipation and the use of African-American soldiers had become military necessities, the president concluded, "In telling this tale, I attempt no compliment to my own sagacity. I claim not to have controlled events, but confess plainly that events have controlled me." From his earliest days, Lincoln had a sense that his destiny was controlled by some larger force, some higher power. Turning away from Orthodox Christianity because of the emotional excesses of frontier evangelicalism, he found it easier as a young man to accept what was called the doctrine of necessity, which he defined as the belief that the human mind is impelled to action, or held in rest, by some power over which the mind itself has no control. Later, he frequently quoted to his partner, William H. Herndon, the lines from Hamlet: "There's a divinity that shapes our ends, rough-hew them how we will." From Lincoln's fatalism derived some of his most lovable traits: his compassion, his tolerance, his willingness to overlook mistakes. That belief didn't, of course, lead him to lethargy or dissipation. Like thousands of Calvinists who believed in predestination, he worked indefatigably for a better world, for himself, for his family, and for his nation. But it helped to buffer the many reverses that he experienced and enabled him to continue a strenuous life of aspiration. It also made for a pragmatic approach to problems, a recognition that if one solution was fated not to work, another could be tried. "My policy is to have no policy," became a kind of motto for Lincoln, a motto that infuriated the sober, doctrinaire people around him, who were inclined to think that the president had no principles either. He might have offended his critics less if he'd more often used the analogy he gave James G. Blaine when explaining his course on Reconstruction: "The pilots on our western rivers steer from point to point, as they call it, setting the course of the boat no farther than they can see. And that's all I propose to myself in this great problem." Both statements suggest Lincoln's reluctance to take the initiative and make bold plans. He preferred to respond to the actions of others. They also show why Lincoln, in his own distinctively American way, had the quality John Keats defined as forming a man of achievement, That quality, which Shakespeare possessed so enormously, negative capability. That is, when a man is capable of being in uncertainties, mysteries, doubts, without any irritable reaching after fact and reason. Chapter 1. Annals of the Poor. Abraham Lincoln wasn't interested in his ancestry. In his mind, he was a self-made man who had no need to care about his family tree. In 1859, when friends asked him for autobiographical information to help promote his chances for a presidential nomination, he offered only the barest outline of his family history. "My parents were both born in Virginia of undistinguished families. Second families, perhaps I should say." The next year, when John Locke Scripps of the Chicago Tribune proposed to write his campaign biography, Lincoln told him, "Why, Scripps, it's a great piece of folly to attempt to make anything out of my early life. It can all be condensed into a single sentence, and that sentence you'll find in Gray's Elegy. The short and simple annals of the poor. That's my life. And that's all you or anyone else can make of it." Lincoln knew almost nothing about his mother's family, the Hankses, who moved from Virginia to Kentucky about 1780. They were a prolific tribe, for the most part illiterate but respectable farmers of modest means. Their family tree is hard to trace because for generation after generation they tended to name all the males James or John and the females Polly, Lucy, or Nancy. Abraham Lincoln's mother was one of at least 8 Nancy Hankses born during the 1780s. Abraham Lincoln believed that his mother was illegitimate. It was a subject that he rarely discussed, but in the early 1850s, while driving his one-horse buggy from Springfield over to Petersburg, Illinois, he found himself talking about it. He and his law partner, William H. Herndon, were about to try a case in Menard County Court that involved a question of hereditary traits. And Lincoln observed that illegitimate children were oftentimes sturdier and brighter than those born in lawful wedlock. To prove his point, he mentioned his mother, who, he said, was the illegitimate daughter of Lucy Hanks and a well-bred Virginia farmer or planter. From this broad-minded, unknown Virginian, Lincoln believed he inherited the traits that distinguished him from the other members of his family: ambition, mental alertness, and the power of analysis. Lincoln may well have been correct in reporting that his mother was born out of wedlock. A grand jury in Mercer County, Kentucky, presented a charge of fornication against his grandmother, Lucy, and there were several recorded instances of bastardy among Hank's women of her generation. Since no wedding certificate was ever found for Lucy, there was room for endless speculation about Lincoln's maternal grandsire. But Lincoln's remarks, if Herndon accurately reported them after a lapse of many years, weren't based on any research into his Hank's ancestry. Instead, they reflected his sense that he was different from the people with whom he grew up. Like other gifted young men, he wondered how he could be the offspring of his ordinary and limited parents. Some in Lincoln's generation fancied themselves the sons of the Dauphin, who allegedly fled to America during the French Revolution. Lincoln imagined a noble Virginia ancestor. Of his Lincoln ancestors, he knew only a little more than he did about the Hankses. From his father, he learned that his grandfather Abraham, for whom he was named, had moved from Virginia to Kentucky in the early 1780s. There was a vague family tradition that earlier Lincolns had lived in Pennsylvania, where they'd been Quakers. But, as he recorded, the family had long since fallen away from the peculiar habits of that people. Apart from that, William Dean Howells reported in his 1860 campaign biography, there was only incertitude and absolute darkness about Abraham Lincoln's forebears. Further research would have showed that the Lincolns did come from Virginia, and that an earlier generation had indeed belonged to the Society of Friends in Pennsylvania. In turn, these could be traced to the original Samuel Lincoln, who emigrated from the county of Norfolk, England, and settled in Hingham, Massachusetts, in 1637. A weaver in England, Samuel became a prosperous trader and businessman in America, where he was a pillar of the church and begat 11 children who bore names like Daniel, Thomas, Mordecai, and Sarah, which became traditional in the family. Samuel's grandson, Mordecai, 1686 to 1736, was perhaps the most successful member of the family. An ironmaster and wealthy landowner in Pennsylvania, he was a member of the 18th century economic and social elite. He married Hannah Slater, who was at once the daughter, the niece, and the granddaughter of members of the New Jersey Assembly, and the niece of the acting royal governor of that colony. It was their son John Lincoln, 1716 to 1788, who moved to the Shenandoah Valley of Virginia, where he established himself on a large farm in fertile Rockingham County. John was so successful that he could afford to give his son, Abraham Lincoln's grandfather, 210 acres of the best soil in Virginia. In sum, Abraham Lincoln, instead of being the unique blossom on an otherwise barren family tree, belonged to the seventh American generation of a family with competent means, a reputation for integrity, and a modest record of public service. A closer study of the historical records would also have given Abraham Lincoln a different, and probably a kindlier, view of his father, Thomas. It was Thomas's father, the senior Abraham Lincoln, who sold his farm in Virginia and led his wife and 5 children over the mountains to seek their fortune. They'd heard much of the rich lands in Kentucky from their distant relative Daniel Boone, and they found in that vast, largely unsettled territory, which was still a part of the Commonwealth of Virginia, all the opportunities Boone had promised. Within a few years, the Lincolns owned at least 5,544 acres of land in the richest sections of Kentucky. But the wilderness was dangerous. In 1786, while Abraham Lincoln and his 3 boys, Mordecai, Josiah, and Thomas, were planting a cornfield on their new property, Indians attacked them. Abraham was killed instantly. Mordecai, at 15, the oldest son, sent Josiah running to the settlement half a mile away for help, while he raced to a nearby cabin. Peering out of a crack between the logs, he saw an Indian sneaking out of the forest toward his 8-year-old brother Thomas, who was still sitting in the field beside their father's body. Mordecai picked up a rifle, aimed at a silver pendant on the Indian's chest, and killed him before he could reach the boy. This story, in later years, Thomas Lincoln repeated over and over again so that it became, as Abraham said, "the legend more strongly than all others imprinted upon my mind and memory." Both Thomas Lincoln and his son seem to have overlooked the economic consequences of the tragedy. According to Virginia law, which prevailed in the Kentucky region, the ancient rule of primogeniture was still in effect, and Mordecai Lincoln, the oldest son, inherited his father's entire estate when he came of age. In due course, he became a respected citizen of Washington County, Kentucky, a man of considerable property who was interested in breeding horses. The only Lincoln relative whom Abraham Lincoln ever knew, Mordecai was a man of considerable wit and great natural gifts, and his nephew once remarked that Uncle Mort had run off with all the talents of the family. He had also, in effect, run off with all the money. Left without a patrimony, the other two Lincoln boys had to fend for themselves. Thomas, the youngest, had a difficult time. The tragedy abruptly ended his prospects of being an heir of a well-to-do Kentucky planter. He had to earn his board and keep. Abraham Lincoln never fully understood how hard his father had to struggle during his early years. It required an immense effort for Thomas, who earned 3 shillings a day for manual labor, or made a little more when he did carpentry or cabinet making, to accumulate enough money to buy his first farm, a 238-acre tract on Mill Creek in Hardin County, Kentucky. He became a familiar figure in Elizabethtown and Hogdenville, a stocky, well-built man of no more than average height, with a shock of straight black hair and an unusually large nose. He was an uneducated man, a plain, unpretending, plodding man, a neighbor remembered, one who attended to his work, peaceable, quiet, and good-natured. Honest was the adjective most frequently used to describe Thomas Lincoln, and he was respected in his community, where he served in the militia and was called for jury duty. Never wealthy, Thomas owned a respectable amount of property, by 1814 ranking 15th out of 98 listed in the county. In 1806, he married Nancy Hanks, and they probably lived at Mill Creek, about 5 miles north of Elizabethtown, where their first child, Sarah, was born. By 1809, Thomas Lincoln had bought another farm, this time one of 300 acres on the South Fork of Nolan Creek, not far from Hogdenville. It was called the Sinking Spring Farm, because it had a magnificent spring that bubbled from the bottom of a deep cave. Here, on a little knoll near the spring, he built a 1-room log cabin, measuring 16 by 18 feet. The sturdy building, which had only a dirt floor and no glass window, was as large as about 90% of the pioneer cabins of the region. Here, Abraham Lincoln was born on February 12, 1809. He had no recollection of the place of his birth, because his parents moved before he was 2 years old. The land on the Sinking Spring farm proved very poor, a barren waste, so to speak, as one contemporary described it, save some little patches on the creek bottoms. And Thomas quickly learned that it wouldn't support his family. He bought a smaller but more fertile farm, some 10 miles to the northeast, on Knob Creek. Here, once again, the family lived, as did most of their neighbors, in a 1-room log cabin. But the setting was beautiful. The creek, which ran through the property, was so clear that you could see a pebble in 10 feet of water. The bottom land, where Thomas planted corn, was rich and easy to cultivate. And on both sides rose small, steep hills, so clearly defined and separate as to be called knobs, after which the creek was named. It was of this Knob Creek farm that Abraham Lincoln had his earliest memories. But few of them concerned his mother, who remains a shadowy image. It's not even clear what she looked like. No one ever bothered to draw a likeness of Nancy Hanks Lincoln, and the age of photography was far in the future. Many years later, those who'd known her described her variously as being tall or of average height, thin or stout, beautiful or plain. Most agreed that she was brilliant or intellectual. According to tradition, she was able to read, but like many other frontier women, she didn't know how to write and had to sign legal documents with an X. Abraham must have remembered how his mother set up housekeeping, cooked the family meals, washed and mended the scanty clothing that her husband and children wore, and perhaps helped in the farming. But of her life on Knob Creek he recorded only that she gave birth to a third child, named Thomas, who died in infancy. On the rare occasions in later years when he mentioned her, he referred to his angel mother, partly in recognition of her loving affection, but partly to distinguish her from his stepmother, who was very much alive. If he ever said, as Herndon reported, "God bless my mother, all that I am or ever hope to be I owe to her," it was a tribute not so much to her maternal care as to the genes that she allegedly transmitted from his unnamed grandfather. Lincoln's Knob Creek recollections were of working in what he called the big field of 7 acres, where his father planted corn and the sun followed, dropping 2 pumpkin seeds in every other hill on every other row. Once, as he remembered, there was a big rain in the hills, though not a drop fell in the valley, and the water coming down through the gorges washed ground, corn, pumpkin seed, and all clear off the field. He also remembered going for 2 brief periods to an ABC school, some 2 miles from the Lincoln's cabin, where he was sent, according to a relative, more as company for his sister than with the expectation that he would learn much. It was first taught by one Zachariah Riney, about whom little is known except that he was a Catholic, and then by Caleb Hazel, who, according to a contemporary, could perhaps teach spelling, reading, and indifferent writing, and perhaps could cipher to the rule of 3, but had no other qualifications of a teacher except large size and bodily strength to thrash any boy or youth that came to his school. Abraham probably mastered the alphabet, but he didn't yet know how to write when the family left Kentucky. In general, young Lincoln seems to have been an entirely average little boy, who enjoyed playing, hunting, and fishing. Perhaps he was quieter than his playmates and kept his clothes clean longer, but there wasn't much to distinguish him. As a relative declared, "Abe exhibited no special traits in Kentucky except a good, kind, somewhat wild nature." In 1816, when Abraham was only 7 years old, the Lincolns moved across the Ohio River to Indiana. Many years later, he stated, quite accurately, that his father left Kentucky partly on account of slavery, but chiefly on account of the difficulty in land titles in Kentucky. In Thomas Lincoln's mind, the 2 causes were interrelated. He had religious grounds for disliking slavery, He and his wife joined the separate Baptist church, whose members accepted traditional Baptist beliefs, like predestination and opposition to infant baptism, but refused to endorse any formal creed. Adhering to a very strict code of morality, which condemned profanity, intoxication, gossip, horse racing, and dancing, most of the separate Baptists were opposed to slavery. Abraham shared his parents' views. He was naturally anti-slavery, he remarked in 1864, adding, "I can't remember when I didn't so think and feel." Thomas Lincoln's hostility to slavery was based on economic as well as religious grounds. He didn't want to compete with slave labor. Kentucky had been admitted to the Union in 1792 as a slave state. And in the central bluegrass region of the state, nabobs were accumulating vast holdings of the best lands tilled by gangs of black slaves. Hardin County, just to the west of this region, wasn't so well suited to large-scale agriculture, but its inhabitants felt threatened. By 1811, the county had 1,007 slaves and only 1,627 white males over the age of 16. Small farmers like Thomas Lincoln also worried about the titles to their land. Kentucky never had a United States land survey. It was settled in a random, chaotic fashion, with settlers fixing their own bounds to the property they claimed. A particular tree here, a rock there, and so on. Soon the map of the state presented a bewildering overlay of conflicting land claims, and nobody could be sure who owned what. So uncertain were land titles that Kentucky became one of the first states to do away with the freehold property qualification for voting. Not so much out of devotion to democratic principles as because even the wealthy often had trouble proving they owned clear title to their acres. Naturally, the courts were filled with litigation, and the lawyers in Kentucky were busy all the time. To a small farmer like Thomas Lincoln, who was unable to pay the attorney's fees, it seemed that they were all working for the rich, slaveholding planters. He had trouble gaining a clear title to any of the three farms that he purchased in Kentucky. The details were exceedingly complicated and not particularly important. One had been improperly surveyed, so that it proved to be 38 acres smaller than what he thought he'd purchased. Another had a lien on it because of a small debt by a previous owner. In the case of the Knob Creek farm, non-Kentucky residents brought suit against Thomas and other occupants of the Rich Valley, claiming prior title, having neither the money nor the inclination to fight for his claims in court. He heard with great interest of the opening of Indiana, territory from which slavery had been excluded by the Northwest Ordinance. Here the United States government had surveyed the land and offered purchasers guaranteed titles to their farms. In the fall of 1816, he made a trip across the Ohio to explore the region and stake out a claim. He found what he wanted in the heavily wooded, almost totally unoccupied, wilderness on Little Pigeon Creek, in Perry, later Spencer, County, in southern Indiana. After selecting the site, he constructed what was called a half-faced camp, a rough shelter with no floor, about 14 feet square, and closed on three sides but open on the fourth. Then, blazing trees to mark the boundaries and heaping piles of brush on the corners of the tract he expected to occupy, he returned to Kentucky gathered his small family and his few possessions, and set out for his new home. The Lincolns arrived in Indiana just as the territory was admitted to the Union as a state. The land, Thomas claimed, was in an unbroken forest, so remote that for part of the distance from the Ohio there was no trail, and he had to hack out a path so that his family could follow. It was a wild region, Abraham remembered, and the forests were filled with bears and other threatening animals. Many years later, when he revisited the region, his childhood fears surfaced in verse. "When first my father settled here, 'twas then the frontier line. The panther's scream filled night with fear, and bears preyed on the swine." The Lincolns stayed in the half-faced camp for a few days after they arrived until Thomas, probably with the assistance of members of the seven other families in the general vicinity, built a proper log cabin. It offered more protection, but because of the freezing weather, the men couldn't work up the usual mixture of clay and grass for chinking between the logs, and the wind still swept through. The family was able to get through the winter because they ate deer and bear meat. "We all hunted pretty much all the time," one of the party remembered. Young Abraham did his part, too. In February 1817, just before his 8th birthday, he spied a flock of wild turkeys outside the new log cabin. He seized a rifle and, taking advantage of one of the chinks, shot through a crack and killed one of them. But killing wasn't for him, and he didn't try to repeat his exploit. Recalling the incident years later, he said that he had never since pulled a trigger on any larger game. The immediate task before the Lincolns was to clear away enough trees and undergrowth so that they could plant corn. Thomas could only do so much, and he had to enlist the services of his son. Though Abraham was only 8 years old, he was, he recalled, large of his age and had an axe put into his hands at once. And from that till within his 23rd year, he was almost constantly handling that most useful instrument, less, of course, in plowing and harvesting seasons. That first year in Indiana was a time of back-breaking toil and of desperate loneliness for all the family. But by fall, they were fairly settled. Thomas was so satisfied with the site that he'd chosen that he undertook the 60-mile trip to Vincennes in order to make initial payments on two adjoining 80-acre tracts he had claimed. Nancy also began to feel more at home, because Elizabeth Hanks and Thomas Sparrow, her aunt and uncle, who'd lost their home in Kentucky through an ejectment suit, came to the Little Pigeon Creek neighborhood. They stayed for a while in the Lincolns' half-faced camp until they could build their own cabin on a nearby lot. Sarah and Abraham rejoiced because the Sparrows brought with them the 18-year-old Dennis Hanks, illegitimate nephew of Elizabeth Sparrow. They had known Dennis in Kentucky. Indeed, he claimed to be the second person to touch Abraham after his birth. And they welcomed this young man of endless loquacity and irrepressible good spirits. But shortly afterward, everything began to go wrong. First, Abraham had a dangerous accident. One of his chores was to take corn over to Gordon's mill, some 2 miles distant, to be ground into meal. When he got there, he hitched his old mare to the arm of the grist mill. Because it was getting late and he was in a hurry to get home before dusk, he tried to speed up the mare by giving her a stroke of the whip with each revolution. She lashed out at him with a kick that landed on his forehead, and he fell bleeding and unconscious. At first, it was thought that he was dead, and his father was summoned. He couldn't speak for several hours, but he revived and suffered no permanent damage. Then the little Pigeon Creek community was devastated by an attack of what was called milk sickness. It was a mysterious ailment which settlers realized was somehow connected with the milk of their cows. But it wasn't until many years later that scientists discovered that the cows, which ran wild in the forest, had been eating the luxuriant but poisonous white snake root plant. Dizziness, nausea, and stomach pains were the initial symptoms, followed by irregular respiration and pulse, prostration, and coma. Death usually occurred within 7 days. Thomas and Elizabeth Sparrow were first afflicted, and Thomas Lincoln sawed rough boards to make coffins to bury them in. Then Nancy fell ill. She struggled on, day after day, for a week, but she knew she was failing. Calling her children to her bedside, she told them to be good and kind to their father, to one another and to the world. She died on October 5th. And Thomas Lincoln buried another coffin on a wooded knoll a quarter of a mile from the cabin. The next year may have been the hardest in Abraham Lincoln's life. With the help of Dennis Hanks, who moved in with the Lincolns after the Sparrows died, Thomas was able to put food on the table. "We still kept up hunting and farming," Dennis remembered. "We always hunted. It made no difference what came, for we more or less depended on it for a living, nay, for life." Sarah, who had her 12th birthday in February 1819, tried to cook and keep house, but at times she felt so lonesome that she would sit by the fire and cry. To cheer her up, Dennis recalled, "Me and Abe got her a baby coon and a turtle and tried to get a fawn, but we couldn't catch any." Abe, as Dennis and the other children insisted on calling the boy, even though he always disliked the nickname, left no words describing his sense of loss. His wound was too sensitive to touch. But many years later, he wrote a letter of condolence to a bereaved child. "In this sad world of ours, sorrow comes to all. And to the young it comes with bitterest agony, because it takes them unawares. I've had experience enough to know what I say." Deeper consequences of the loss of his mother before he was 10 years old can only be a matter of speculation. It's tempting to trace his subsequent moodiness, his melancholy, and his occasional bouts of depression to this cause, but the connections aren't clear, and those patterns of behavior appear in persons who've never experienced such loss. Perhaps his mother's death had something to do with his growing aversion to cruelty and bloodshed. Now he began to reprove other children in the neighborhood for senseless cruelty to animals. He scolded them when they caught terrapins and heaped hot coals in their shells to force the defenseless animals out of their shells, reminding them that an ant's life was to it as sweet as ours to us. Certainly the death of his mother, coming so soon after the deaths of other friends and neighbors, gave a gloomy cast to his memories of his Indiana home. In the 1840s, revisiting his old neighborhood, he recorded his thoughts in verse. "My childhood's home I see again and sadden with a view, and still, as memories crowd my brain, there's pleasure in it too. I range the fields with pensive tread and pace the hollow rooms and feel, companion of the dead, I'm living in the tomb." Within a year of Nancy's death, Thomas Lincoln recognized that he and his family couldn't go on alone, and he went back to Kentucky to seek a bride. In Elizabethtown, he found Sarah Bush Johnston, whom he'd perhaps unsuccessfully courted before he wed Nancy. She was the widow of the Hardin County jailer and mother of three small children. There was no time for a romantic engagement. He needed a wife, and she needed a husband. They made a quick, businesslike arrangement for him to pay her debts and for her to pack up her belongings and move with him to Indiana. The arrival of Sarah Lincoln marked a turning point in Abraham Lincoln's life. She brought with her, first, her collection of domestic possessions, comfortable bedding, a walnut bureau that had cost her $45, a table and chairs, a spinning wheel, knives, forks, and spoons, so that the Lincoln children felt they were joining a world of unbelievable luxury. Her children, Elizabeth, John D., and Matilda, who ranged from 13 to 8 years in age, brought life and excitement to the depressed Lincoln family. But most of all, she brought with her the gift of love. Sarah Bush Lincoln must have been touched to see the dirty, ill-clad, hungry Lincoln children, and she set to work at once, as she said, to make them look more human. She soaped, rubbed, and washed the children clean, Dennis Hanks remembered, so that they looked pretty neat, well, and clean. At her suggestion, the whole household was reorganized. Thomas Lincoln and Dennis Hanks had to give up hunting for a while to split logs and make a floor for the cabin. And they finished the roof, constructed a proper door, and cut a hole for a window, which they covered with greased paper. The cabin was high enough to install a loft, reached by climbing pegs driven into the wall, and here she installed beds for the three boys, Dennis Hanks, Abraham, and John D. Downstairs she had the whole cabin cleaned, a decent bedstead was built, and Thomas used his skill as a carpenter to make another table and stools. Remarkably, these reforms were brought about with a minimum of friction. What was even more extraordinary, Sarah Bush Lincoln was able to blend the two families harmoniously and without jealousy. She treated her own children and the Lincoln children with absolute impartiality. She grew especially fond of Abraham. "Abe never gave me a cross word or look, and never refused in fact or even in appearance to do anything I requested him," she remembered. "I never gave him a cross word in all my life. His mind and mine, what little I had, seemed to move together, move in the same channel." Many years later, attempting to compare her son and her stepson, she told an interviewer, "Both were good boys, but I must say, both now being dead, that Abe was the best boy I ever saw or ever expect to see." Starved for affection, Abraham returned her love. He called her Mama, and he never spoke of her except in the most affectionate terms. After he'd been elected president, he recalled the sorry condition of Thomas Lincoln's household before Sarah Bush Johnston arrived and told of the encouragement she'd given him as a boy. "She'd been his best friend in this world," a relative reported him as saying, "and no man could love a mother more than he loved her." The years after Sarah Bush Lincoln came to Indiana were happy ones for young Abraham. Afterward, when he spoke of this time, it was as a joyous, happy boyhood, which he described with mirth and glee. And in his recollections, there was nothing sad nor pinched and nothing of want. His parents enrolled him, along with the other four children in the household, in the school that Andrew Crawford had opened in a cabin about a mile from the Lincoln house. Though Sarah Bush Lincoln was illiterate, she had a sense that education was important, and Thomas wanted his son to learn how to read and cipher. Possibly young Lincoln knew how to read a little before he entered Crawford School, but Dennis Hanks, who was only marginally literate himself, claimed credit for giving Abraham his first lesson in spelling, reading, and writing. "I taught Abe to write with a buzzard's quill, which I killed with a rifle, and, having made a pen, put Abe's hand in mine, and moving his fingers by my hand to give him the idea of how to write." Abraham learned these basic skills slowly. John Hanks, another cousin who lived with the Lincolns for a time, thought he was somewhat dull, not a brilliant boy, but worked his way by toil. To learn was hard for him, but he worked slowly but surely. But Abraham's stepmother understood him better, recognized his need fully to master what he read or heard. He must understand everything, even to the smallest thing, minutely and exactly, she remembered. He'd then repeat it over to himself again and again, sometimes in one form and then in another, and when it was fixed in his mind to suit him, he never lost that fact or his understanding of it. Abraham attended Crawford School for one term, of perhaps 3 months. Crawford, a justice of the peace and man of some importance in the area, ran a subscription school where parents paid their children's tuition in cash or in commodities. Ungraded, it was a blab school, where students recited their lessons aloud and the schoolmaster listened through the din for errors. He was long remembered because, according to one student, he tried to learn us manners by having the pupils practice introducing each other as though they were strangers. After one term, Crawford gave up teaching, and the Lincoln children had no school for a year, until James Swaney opened one about 4 miles from the Lincoln house. The distance was so great that Abraham, who had farm chores to perform, could attend only sporadically. The next year, for about 6 months, he went to a school taught by Azel W. Dorsey, in the same cabin that Crawford had used. With that term, at the age of 15, his formal education ended. All told, he summarized, the aggregate of all his schooling didn't amount to 1 year. In later years, Lincoln was scornful of these schools so-called, which he attended. No qualification was ever required of a teacher beyond reading, writing, and ciphering to the rule of three. That is, ratio and proportions. If a straggler supposed to understand Latin happened to sojourn in the neighborhood, he was looked upon as a wizard. Though his censure was largely deserved, a school system that produced Abraham Lincoln couldn't have been wholly without merit. Indeed, his teachers, transient and untrained as they were, helped him master the basic tools so that in future he could educate himself. Dilworth's spelling book, which he and Sarah had begun to use in Kentucky, provided his introduction to grammar and spelling. Beginning with the alphabet and Arabic and Roman numerals, it proceeded to words of 2 letters, then 3 letters, and finally 4 letters. From these, the student began to construct sentences like, "No man may put off the law of God." Dilworth's then went on to more advanced subjects, and the final sections included prose and verse selections, some accompanied by crude woodcuts, which may have been the first pictures that Abraham had ever seen. Other readers, like the Columbian Class Book, and the Kentucky preceptor expanded and reinforced what he learned from Dilworth's. Through constant repetition and drill, the boy learned how to spell. Indeed, he became so proficient that it was hard to stump him in the school spelling bees. He was generous with his knowledge. Many years later, a girl in his class told how he helped her when the teacher gave her a difficult word, defied, D-E-F-I-E-D, which she was about to misspell, D-E-F-Y-E-D. When she came to the fourth letter, she happened to look at Abraham, who pointed to his eye, and taking the hint, she spelled the word correctly. He also learned to write in a clear, round hand. The handwriting of a bit of doggerel in his sum book is recognizably that of the future president. Abraham Lincoln is my name, and with my pen I wrote the same. I wrote in both haste and speed, and left it here for fools to read. So adept did he become that unlettered neighbors in the Pigeon Creek community often asked him to write letters for them. Even more important was the ability to read. Once he got the hang of it, he could never get enough. "Abe was getting hungry for books," Dennis Hanks recalled, "reading everything he could lay his hands on. He'd carry a book with him when he went out to work and read when he rested." John Hanks remembered that when Abraham returned to the house from work, he'd go to the cupboard, snatch a piece of cornbread, take down a book, sit down in a chair, cock his legs up as high as his head, and read. His contemporaries attributed prodigies of reading to him, but books were scarce on the frontier, and he had to read carefully rather than extensively. He memorized a great deal of what he read. When he came across a passage that struck him, his stepmother remembered, he'd write it down on boards if he had no paper and keep it there till he did get paper. Then he'd rewrite it, look at it, and repeat it. Other than classroom texts, his first books were the few that Sarah Bush Lincoln had brought with her from Kentucky. One was her family Bible. Abraham read it at times, she remembered, though not as much as said. He sought more congenial books suitable for his age. The Pilgrim's Progress was one of them, and the biblical cadences of Lincoln's later speeches owed much to John Bunyan. Another of Sarah Bush Lincoln's books was Aesop's Fables, which it was said Abraham read so many times that he could write it out from memory. The morals of some of the stories became deeply ingrained in his mind, like the lesson drawn from the fable of the lion and the four bulls, a kingdom divided against itself cannot stand. In his stepmother's copy of Lessons in Elocution by William Scott, he studied basic lessons on elocution, and the selections in this book were probably his introduction to Shakespeare. Among the set pieces it included was King Claudius's soliloquy on his murder of Hamlet's father. "Oh, my offense is rank, it smells to heaven." It remained one of Lincoln's favorite passages. History also fascinated him. He probably read William Grimshaw's History of the United States, which began with the discovery of America and ended with the annexation of Florida. With a sharp denunciation of slavery as a climax of human cupidity and turpitude, Grimshaw stressed the importance of the American Revolution and exhorted students, "Let us not only declare by words, but demonstrate by our actions that all men are created equal." Even more than history, biography interested young Lincoln. He enjoyed the autobiography of Benjamin Franklin, but it was Parson Mason Weems's Life of George Washington that stirred his imagination. Many years later, when he was on his way to Washington and his first inaugural, he told the New Jersey Senate that Weems's account of Washington's heroic struggles at Trenton, the crossing of the river, the contest with the Hessians, the great hardships endured at that time, had made an indelible mark on his mind. "I recollect thinking then, boy even though I was," he said, "that there must have been something more than common that those men struggled for." The pioneer schools of Indiana also gave Lincoln a good grounding in elementary mathematics. His teachers probably never used an arithmetic textbook, but drew their problems from two handbooks, Thomas Dilworth's Schoolmaster's Assistant and Zachariah Jess's American Tutor's Assistant. Because paper was scarce, he often had to cipher on boards, and his stepmother recalled, "When the board 'd get too black, he'd shave it off with a drawing knife and go on again." Then, from somewhere, he found a few sheets of paper, which he sewed together to form a little notebook in which to write down the problems and his answers. In it, he recorded complicated calculations involving multiplication, like 34,567,834 times 23,423, and division, such as 4,375,702 divided by 2,432, which he completed with exceptional accuracy. And he also solved problems concerning weights and measures, and figured discounts and simple interest. Apparently, ratio and proportion taxed his instructors to their limits. But he was able to work out simple problems such as, if 3 ounces of silver cost 17 shillings, what will 48 ounces cost? Neither the student nor the teachers seemed quite to get the idea of casting out nines, a cumbersome and inaccurate method of verifying long division. Nevertheless, he liked the logic and the precision of mathematics. And years later, after serving a term in Congress, he went back to the subject and worked his way through most of a geometry textbook. What Lincoln learned from school wasn't all in books. Here, for the first time, he had a chance to see children from other families and to pit his wits against theirs. Taller than most of the other students, he wore a coonskin cap and buckskin pants that were always too short, so that, a classmate remembered, there was bare and naked 6 or more inches of Abe Lincoln's shinbone. Unconscious of his peculiar appearance, he'd rapidly gather the other students around him, cracking jokes, telling stories, making plans. Almost from the beginning, he took his place as a leader. His classmates admired his ability to tell stories and make rhymes, and they enjoyed his first efforts at public speaking. In their eyes, he was clearly exceptional, and he carried away from his brief schooling the self-confidence of a man who's never met his intellectual equal.
This ends Disc 1.